The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1078. It's Tuesday, the 29th of May, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vesarion, VRS is ticker there, and Neil discusses today's collaboration with a FTSE-listed European manufacturer and supplier of co-manufactured and private label consumer products for the household and personal care markets. Also on the podcast, I have Peter Whale, Non-Executive Director of Strategic Minerals, SML. And Peter discusses recent news, including their drill program at their Redmore tin, tungsten and copper project in Cornwall. And I have Brian Larkin, CEO of United Oil and Gas, UOG. Brian gives an update on the company, including today's news on its Selva gas field in Italy and its recent license acquisition in the North Sea. Also on the podcast, I have Joe Salomon, Managing Director of Oilex, OEX. And Joe explains today's news where they've issued an event of default notice to GSPC in the amount of equivalent of US $3 million. Plus, as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vesarion. That's VRS ticker. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. It's nice to talk to you on a Tuesday for a change.
Yeah, maybe it should be the Neil and Justin show because you're on once
we
a week. Because you seem to be on a weekly basis almost. And I was looking back at all the announcements, and you've done sort of 12 major sort of collaborations, or I'm just roughly counting there, could be more, could be less. But run about that in the last, since end of last year. And so it's no exaggeration to say it seems like a weekly basis. But you've done another one today. I've read this before, surely. But a consumer goods collaboration. Before we get into that, Neil, for people who are brand new to the podcast or are not quite familiar with Vesarion, can you explain what you're all about, please?
Yeah, so we're an advanced manufacturing company. Advanced materials is what we specialize in, including the exploitation of graphene with our partners, the University of Cambridge and the University of Manchester.
Excellent stuff. So today you've done a collaboration with a consumer goods company, and it's a big company. It's a FTSE company. And you did one of these a while back as well. I'm assuming it's obviously a different company.
Yeah, totally different company. Again, another big giant, another FTSE listed company, one of the Fortune 500, I think. All the announcements we've done have all been significant players. You know, when these are difficult to negotiate, but substantial and obviously warrant, according to our nomads, the announcements.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go into the announcement. So, what is it you'd be doing, and with who?
Nice try, Justin. It's early in the morning. You almost got away with it then as well. But the thing here is, this is again all around using graphene in polymers and plastics. Something that we're kind of specialising in now. A lot of the collaborations are in the same area, so it means that we can use the knowledge that the company's got to try to get going as quickly as we can. They're all significant challenges, and this particular challenge is a massive company that manufactures packaging for almost all of the consumer goods that we use on a daily basis, and they're a big entity, so they make the things that contain the products that we all love. The significant thing here is that they are wanting to be at the forefront of technology. They're wanting to be the world leaders. They're wanting to grow. And they see that graphene, and particularly our nanine derivative, is going to be key in reducing plastic, which is being pushed by government. And we all know our links with the UK government. But the agenda is about reducing plastic and improving the mechanical strength so that we can stop all of the things that have been in the news recently.
Yeah, exactly. And And how does this fit? I mean, so you've got that one with the, I mean, other company as well. And so how does this, I mean, how does this work? How does this help reduce, you know, packaging and plastic packaging? What does it do? What does Nanning do?
Well, what we're doing is we use the very, very small quantity of our Nanning powder into their plastics for things like bottles or containers, and improving the mechanical strength so we can get away with using as much plastic. And that is a major driver for everybody. It's a major driver for the consumers. It's a major driver for the government. It's a major driver for the companies. And therefore, the packaging companies have got to follow. They have no choice. And this company wants to be at the forefront of that. So this is actually a company that works very closely with one of the other companies that we did the collaboration. They've got a fairly unique relationship. That they are a supplier and also a competitor. They want to drive quickly, and you know, so when we're looking for collaborations, it's not that we're fussy or that we that we can be too arrogant at the moment, but what we do look for and what really strikes a chord with us are companies that can move quicker than other companies, and this is one of those companies.
Yeah, and are you getting that traction because you're now associated with other big companies? Do they do you pitch to them, or are companies pitching to you now, or what's the score?
We've got a very, very small sales team. We're completely overrun. I'm a key part of that team, although I'm extremely well supported by people like David Kerr, and who's driving through a lot of these collaborations. But we're not out there actively marketing the company. We are being targeted by these companies, which is a completely unique proposition for me. I've never been in a business where these, you know, world leaders are knocking on your door asking whether or not they can work with this small company from Gloucestershire. Mm-hmm. And it gives you an indication of how good the product is and how important it's going to be for everybody moving forward.
Yeah. Well, let's be honest. I mean, I was just trying to think of a sort of a similar sort of analogy, and I thought, you know, if I approach a celebrity, listen, and I said to them, listen, I'm a nutritionist and I work with Kim Kardashian, J Lo, and Victoria Beckham, then, you know, they'll take you seriously, won't they? You know,
that's part of it, you know. And some of these collaborations we can name, others that we can't, obviously for competitive reasons. They want to keep that competitive advantage. But what we do know is that the more we get. And so, you know, this is quickly turning into an upward spiral, if it's not already an upward spiral, and we've got a lot to go at, and we've hardly scratched the surface at the moment, to be honest. The team is very busy. We're getting good results from the collaborations that we're already working on. It's always a challenge. This is a brand new science. Nothing ever goes quite right first time. But because of the types of relationships we've got, it's not a one-shot wonder. The other thing to pull out from this announcement is it's multiple projects, which is what's happening in almost all of our collaborations. They are multiple projects with multiple products to solve multiple problems, which means as the largest shareholder, the risk factor for the business now is greatly reduced.
Yeah, and so this, when you enter into collaboration, it's largely going through a testing period. How long do these testing periods, I know it was probably like asking how long is a piece of string, but have you any idea how long this testing period lasts for and when you get results from it?
It really does vary customer to customer and sector to sector and product to product. What we're trying to aim to do is to do it in the very quickest period of time we can, and also to have a good balance. So stuff that moves very, very quickly, stuff that moves slightly longer, and stuff that's long-term. And that's our key strategy. But we're trying to work with the right people in the right sectors to be able to get this done as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Shareholders have to understand that there is a time, and I know it's a bit like waiting for Christmas when you're 5 years old, but we're doing, the company is doing all the right things, it's doing all the right testing, it's got the right partners, and for me, as I say, as a shareholder, it's great to see one of these, let alone, as you said, 12, in a very short period of time, and also knowing what I know, which is there's a lot more that we're working on as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you said they're all different lengths, and obviously the structures of these collaborations are differently made up, different structures, but what are they, I mean, do you get revenue from them, or will that come in the future?
No, we get revenue for the testing. We never give away anything for free. We don't believe that that's good business. We think that if a customer gets something for free, they probably don't really value it. It's always a tough negotiation. That's where some of the times you come around. The quantities tend to be quite small to start with, but then we're starting to chunk up as the programs get more developed and people start to see more results. And so, you know, we'd like to be able to tell our shareholders in the very near future exactly how we're getting on with those collaborations, and when we have the opportunity and we have the data from our customers, then we will do.
Yeah, okay. One final question. I mean, obviously, like you said, you've got a lot of collaborations going on, but in your mind, you know, internally with Basera in there, what's the number one priority for you at the moment? What's the thing that's keeping you up all night, apart from all the work you need to do?
We've got several things going on at the moment. We've got international expansion, which we're working very heavily on. We're working on these collaborations, which is really, really important. You know, just getting a collaboration isn't good enough. You need to get good test results. You need to be working very closely with the customer. Then the third thing is to work on the stuff that's coming. You know, you have to understand that the market's at least 6 months behind where the CEO is, and in some cases, probably 2 years behind where the CEO is. So, you know, I've got to look at where the company's going to be in 2 or 3 years time, if not longer, and make sure we've got enough work for them as well. So having collaborations is great. The team continues to work on those collaborations independently of what I'm doing. I'm looking for the next stuff, and to be honest, that's a good place to be.
Yeah. Okay, well, Neil, one final thing, you know the score here. If someone's listening to this and likes the sound of what you're doing but are not yet following you on Vox Markets, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
The first thing is that this is now being de-risked. The more collaborations we get, this collaboration that we've announced today is a good indication of the types of work that we're working on. Second thing is that this is a brand new technology. This is a brand new science that's being developed. And if you're going to develop a brand new science, there's no one better to have on board than the University of Manchester and the University of Cambridge. And the last thing is that I'm still a largest shareholder, and therefore my direction, my strategies are all in line with the other shareholders.
Marvellous stuff, Neil. Thanks for that. And hopefully, I know we'll be chatting again soon, probably.
Sorry.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Peter Whale, Non-Executive Director of Strategic Minerals. That's SML ticker. You're right, Peter.
Hi, Justin. Good morning.
Now, as always, you know, with a company with a lot of things going on, you've had quite a few bits of news out since we last chatted, so we'll catch up on that in a bit. Before we do, for people tuning in for the first time or not aware of Strategic Minerals, summarise, if you could, Pete. I know it's not easy, but summarise in a minute or less, what are you all about?
Okay, let's try and do that. We were actually told recently by somebody that we were in the top decile of our peer group in that we actually made profits and had cash on the balance sheet and had a producing asset. So if that differentiates us a little bit, then that's great. Now, that's derived solely, the profits come from our Cobra magnetite stockpile operation in New Mexico. In addition to that, we just bought a copper mine, which we're looking to reactivate, Lee Creek, which is in South Australia. We also have an exploration project in Western Australia, which is targeting nickel, cobalt, gold, and rare earths. And finally, we have a joint venture down in Cornwall, where we are targeting tin, tungsten, and copper. We've had a drill program last year, and I'll talk later about what's going on there as well.
Yes, yeah, so you are over quite a few commodities that are, you know, have, if you read reports and listen to the experts, have an exciting few years ahead, or exciting decade or so ahead. You know, in copper, in cobalt, nickel, and tin as well, you pointed out a while back, there's we're going to be in short supply. So let's start with Redmore, because you announced last week a drilling program there. What's happening at Redmore in Cornwall there?
Sure, yeah, to just tap into what you were saying, I mean, we always had a strategy selecting the metals and resources that we felt had material upside or demand supply imbalance. We haven't just picked projects for the sake of that sounds nice. We've really had a very sensible and serious screening process. So it's evolved. I mean, it's actually 2 years this weekend since we first vended into Redmoor, and there's been an awful lot that's happened over those 2 years in terms of building a team. You know, it's been an investment that's actually moved forward and created some value. There are a lot of intangibles as well. We've had around 25 local meetings integrating with the community and educating them. And that's not something you just create overnight. I read a lot about Sirius Minerals in Yorkshire recently, and it did remind me, they talked about, we started off in pubs meeting people and telling us about our project. Well, our first meeting was in a pub as well. We followed exactly the same model, and I can really relate to what they're doing. So we had 20 drills last year, and now, as we announced on Friday, we're moving forward to do a further drilling program. And the main target of this is to expand the resource definition, which we've got. Mm-hmm. So we previously announced 4.5 million ton resource at around 1% tin. And based on the modeling that we've done, that gives a mine life of around 10 years. However, in order to have a more significant project with better economics and more worthwhile, we feel probably about 10 million tons is enough that will give us some decent numbers, bearing in mind that our assumptions for tin, tungsten and copper are really very close to the current market levels. And I would argue that there's upside significantly in all of those. I wouldn't like to call which one would go up the most, really, but I think perhaps tin and tungsten have the most optionality going forward in terms of upside. But the new drill program, the primary goal is to expand that resource. Mm-hmm. And we have an exploration target. If we can tick off that and it helps fill in the gaps in the resource, as well as perhaps tap a few other areas, then that gets us to our goal where we want to be, and that enables us to move forward with a more formal feasibility for the project, which then brings it much closer to reality. Now, the drill program, we've always been very organic with what we do. We've got a good framework at the moment to start off, and we are also going to be going deeper. We found that the grade has improved as you go deeper, but we have very obvious gaps in our current resource definition where we're going to target and do infill drilling, and that should, all things being equal, be an easy win to move forward. You'll notice that in the announcement, we agreed to underwrite our partner's contribution if they're not able to contribute themselves. And as a result of that, we could move to a 60% ownership of the project. Now, this is something that I think some people have spotted and focused on. Ultimately, we've got a great relationship with New Age. We share a chairman in Alan Broom. Gary Feetz contributes an awful lot to the project. Bear in mind, this was NAE's asset in the first place before we got involved. We believe and expect and anticipate that they will fund their way. But if they don't, then there's a plan in place. And I credit John Peters, our MD, for structuring this deal that it's actually a very friendly deal. Even if we did do this, we keep 50-50 control, and that's how much we value NAE's input into this. So we'll see what happens. We don't know with any certainty what will happen, but I think we're confident that NAE will be able to fund their share, but we have a plan if they can't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and let's go back a bit further, and you've just released, of course, your financial results. Take us through some of the highlights, if you could, Peter, from that.
It's funny, really, because everything is a highlight in that release. Now, people look at finals and they think, okay, well, that's largely historical, it's sort of out of date, and that's very much true. And that's why when you get to see our annual report, and the graphic's already been put out on Twitter, but there's some graphs which show our sales, our operating profit, our investments as well. And you know, the graphs only go one way, and we've got a 3-year graph which clearly shows the transformation of the company that's occurred. when I invested in this company originally around 5 years ago, it was had recovery potential and a turnaround story. I'd argue that stage one is very much complete in terms of the initial recovery stage. Now we're moving forward to move up the gears to build a much larger company. So it's hard to really highlight anything stand out in the finals, because for me, it's something to be really proud of. It's the second year of profitability. It's completely legitimate. There's cash on the balance sheet. There's sales moving forward. There's diversification into projects. It's almost more what happened after the annual report that's moved things forward with Lee Creek and that sort of thing. And you look at where the share price is, and it's always sort of hard to commentate on the share price too much, but it's probably at a psychological level here around the 1.5p. There's sort of a lot of focus on what's going on for us. The market will decide ultimately. We met recently with our largest shareholder, Charles Manners, and I've said previously that Strategic Minerals is the sort of share you can sleep at night with. I'd stand very much by that, and Charles Manners is sleeping well at night. I'm very confident of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look at it. I mean, you talk about there's lots of highlights, but one of them has got to be the threefold increase in domestic sales of Cobre. And is that going to continue to perform like that, do you think, Peter?
That's definitely an elephant in the room question. Because we have a situation ongoing with our largest customer, which is something that it's hard to comment specifically on because it's an ongoing situation, but I do expect an update soon. I'm confident, as far as things stand, that sales will be, you know, in the higher range of how they have been as a normalized situation. And I'm confident that we will have a way forward with our customer as well. But clearly, that's a concern for investors. We've shown two quarters of extremely high sales, and it's now dropped down. We always did say that, you know, there perhaps was an additional level of sales that was factored in, which was overly boosting. But even so, you know, we weren't foreseeing what's actually happened with our largest customer. Mm. But if I sort of took the view, let's be worst case scenario, which I'm sure isn't going to be the case, but if we don't make any more sales to this customer, we had a second large customer that we added before that, and that was the customer that turned us profitable, and that customer is still there. There are no issues with that customer. And if you sort of extrapolate the NPV of what Cobre is worth to us, now I know we don't own it, we operate it, but we've had renewals every year. The value of that stockpile going forward is not going away. Yes, we haven't sold it, but it's still there for us to sell. And you could really argue that perhaps that is the sort of base case valuation for Strategic Minerals right here, without factoring anything else. And the other, in terms of anything else, let's not even mention Cornwall or Care specifically, because I think, you know, they're at different stages of development. But Lee Creek is a near producing asset. People have definitely got questions on the history, on our credibility in terms of can we move forward, can we produce copper again. There are definitely lots of question marks. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely our top priority. And like John has said recently, we will get it back into operation. We've already budgeted for what we need to do in the next 12 months. I think we're taking very much the belt and braces approach. We're not going for a quick win here. We're going for the long game, because this will be our most significant project moving forward.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, Lee Creek there, you said that, and it is significant. But as yet, you know, it doesn't seem to be priced in, because you are around about 20 million market cap. It's sort of underpinned the sales at Cobre alone, underpinned your valuation. Why do you think that is, then?
That really is the market, I think. It comes back a little bit to probably some some longer term investors that have been very, very happy to make decent money in our stock and have gradually cashed in, and that sort of biases things. But otherwise, apart from the recent news on Cobre, I'm not sure anybody could say we've had any bad news there, quite the opposite. And that's all you can do. The market will decide in the end. We can't control the share price, and we don't sit every day looking at the share price, notwithstanding that John and I are around 6% shareholders in aggregate. But we're here for the long game. We're not here for the next month or the next day or even the next year. This is a multi-year phase of the company, and value will be reflected. It's a question of when, not if, really.
Yeah. Okay.
Marvellous stuff. Well, let's get on to the three reasons then, Peter, why someone should add you to their watch list, because the share price is now, I think, firmly in the sort of buy zone. People do I say that, obviously it's not investment advice, do your own research here, but if you just go through the financial results, and like I said, there's cash on the balance sheet and there's profit there, it's worth looking at right now. So give someone three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Will do. Before I mention those, I just wanted to remind people listening that we have our AGM and shareholders event on the 19th of June next month in Hammersmith. It is primarily for shareholders. So, Justin, I'm not sure whether that will include you or not, but let's see nearer the time. I know you have to travel up to London as well, so there's two issues really you have to get around. But all of our directors will be there, so Alan and also Jeff that we recently added. So as far as the three reasons, I think we sort of touched on it in what we're discussing, and I think Strategic Minerals is hiding in plain sight. There's actually an extreme undervaluation at the moment based on one, potentially two producing assets, one development asset, and some pure exploration. And it does really feel that we're still below the radar at the moment. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it's about the board and the management team. And usually it would be John talking about this. I'd actually like to highlight John as perhaps the most significant value here. He's extremely serious, very hardworking. I mean, whether he's in back at home in Sydney, whether he's traveling, whether he's in Europe, he works non-stop. He's actually trying to take a small break at the moment, but believe me, I know how many emails and calls I'm having, and I'm not sure he is getting much of a break at the moment. Mm-hmm. But shareholders are very fortunate to have such a focused, driven managing director who also has a significant stake in the business, and again, is very focused on what's moving forward. So I just wanted to give John some credit, and also how much I enjoy working with him. So that's something which comes from a large shareholder as well as a fellow board member. The final point is we have the potential for lots of regular material news flow. We don't really do fillers for our NSs. So there'll be assays due from Hans Camp and Mount Weld. There'll be further updates on Cobre, also Lee Creek and Redmore. So you can look forward to plenty of alerts coming through for our NSs, I'm sure.
Marvellous stuff, Peter. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll be chatting again soon, maybe with you and John again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian Larkin, CEO of United Oil and Gas. That's UOG ticker. You're all right, Brian?
All good, and you?
Good, yes, yeah, good to catch up. I know you've been very busy, and we've had a couple of times to try to catch up, and you've had to do something else, and you've had more news because you've had even more news today. But I've written a blog on you. Like I say, I lose track sometimes of what you're actually doing because you've done so much in such a short space of time. But for people, we'll get into sort of bits of news in a bit. But before we do, for people sort of not aware of the company, can you explain what United Oil and Gas is all about, please, Brian?
Yeah, we're a former Tullow Oil team. I started the company in April 2015, and we listed on the 31st of July 2017 with one license and an option agreement in Italy. And since we listed, we've added six more licenses to the portfolio. We've drilled a well in Italy and found gas, so we're now firmly on the road to production. We've also added a super wildcat opportunity with our former employers, Tullo, who are operating a field in Jamaica for us. And most importantly, we've doubled the share price. So we've had a busy 8-9 months since we listed, 10 months since we listed. So we've had a really good run, and our strategy is ultimately to create as much value as we can in our share price. And how we do that is by building a low risk business in Europe, which underpins high impact blue sky exploration opportunities outside of Europe. And Jamaica kind of fits with that latter part, and then the UK business in Italy fits with the European piece.
Yeah, and you know, that's particularly what I like. And you do mention there, you know, your ex-Tullo team, because people are not aware of Tullo. I mean, that was phenomenally successful, wasn't it, to build and acquire strategy, and they went from a minnow to a FTSE 100 company, which, let's be honest, very few companies do. But is your strategy similar to that, do you think, in the way, because you were there when he was sort of doing that? Is it similar?
Yeah, I there is some similarities in saying that if we have 20% of the success that Tullo had, I think every one of our shareholders will be deliriously happy. Mm. But yeah, you know, I mean, our strategy is very similar to Tullo's strategy in its early days and in the late 80s and early 90s. And I guess one of the things that kind of, you know, aligns us slightly with Tullo is our chairman, Graham Martin, who we appointed in February this year. Graham was 2 decades on Tullo's board, and he led their entire M&A program. And I think during his time with Tullo, I think Graham divested or certainly acquired over $2 billion worth of assets. And what's interesting about Graham is Graham actually was working with Tullo from its very inception in 1986. So he was there when it was one man at his dining table, right up to a FTSE 100 when he retired in 2016. So having Graham on our board is a major validation of the team and the strategy, and helps us and will help facilitate the growth of United.
Yeah, and he's not just there as a sort of, you know, as a symbolic figurehead, but he did take some skin in the bought some shares in the last fundraising, didn't he, as well?
Yes, he subscribed in the last placing, and Graham is he's very much believer in the United story, and he's very, very supportive, and he wouldn't have taken the position as our non-executive chair if he didn't believe in what we were trying to do. And in fairness, Graham was in the background for a little period of time advising us anyway, and we formalised it in February of this year. And to be honest with you, having someone like Graham on our board is just a massive, massive coup for a company of our size.
It's
a fantastic addition, and we're very lucky to have him on board.
Yeah, and it's also good that, like I say, you still have a very, you know, sort of excellent working relationship with Tullo. You know, it's underpinned by that license in Jamaica there, so that's very good. But also, you know, when I point out to people, I recently did a blog saying I think five companies, and you're in this list, five companies I think will outperform in the second half of 2018. You're one of those companies. And that's because I know you're not on AIM, you're on the main list, but a lot of companies on AIM, especially oil and gas, they have one, maybe two, you know, prospects, and one of them is high impact, and the ones with one, you know, high impact sort of wildcat drill. A lot of AIM investors tend to like those, and I think, well, I don't understand why that is, because, you know, the chances of success are very low, aren't they? You know, it's been higher than sort of 5-1. But you've diversified very well across the risks sort of profile.
Well, we've done it quickly, and I guess, you know, before we started United, I was very conscious that I've seen a lot of shareholders burnt in the past, and we were very conscious to try and get the balance right within the portfolio, so that if something doesn't come in, the company won't fall over. So what we've managed to build is a portfolio with no breakers. There's no company breakers in our portfolio whatsoever. Yeah. But there's many company makers within the portfolio. So that kind of protects shareholders on the downside, but gives them access to all of the upside. So it's about balancing that risk, reward, and making sure that the portfolio is diversified so that, as I said, you know, if something didn't come in, the company wouldn't fall over and shareholders won't get wiped out. We still have many other assets in the portfolio. And you know, one thing I want to avoid, though, is having too many assets in the portfolio where you're spread too thin. But I think what we've got is we've got a balanced portfolio across the entire oil and gas exploration the oil and gas life cycle. I mean, we've exploration, we've near-term development, we've near-term production. So we're ticking a lot of boxes. And I guess as the portfolio grows and it's developed, you know, the company will move along on that life cycle.
Yeah, and what's interesting as well is, like you said, you know, you are balanced, and like I said, there's lots of company makers and no company breakers. And I think your broker there underlines that. They've done a sort of their last sort of note was, I think, 13.5 pence diluted. I think so that's more than double where we are at the moment. That doesn't include Jamaica, which is a high impact, and does include your recent acquisition in the North Sea there, the Crown, which is what about 16 million barrels, I think. So those are also company makers, but they're not included in that evaluation, which is still double where you are today. So that's quite nice, that, isn't it? You know,
it is, and you know, we're relatively comfortable with Jamaica and Crown being excluded for the moment. I mean, Crown's probably a little bit early days to be putting too much value on it. We need to execute it. We have a small work program that we need to get on and execute, which we will as soon as the award has been properly formalised. And you know, Jamaica by its nature is it's blue sky, it's frontier exploration. It's hard to put a value on it at this stage. I mean, we've just finished the seismic acquisition. It was ahead of schedule and ahead of budget, which is fantastic. We'll have the first track volume from the vessel probably mid-July time, and we'll start processing that data immediately, probably have a final product later in the year. And then we'll make a decision probably early 19 on whether or not we want to farm it in some equity or stay where we're at, and then hopefully drill a well possibly in late 2020. But you know, Jamaica is potentially the jewel in the crown. It's a huge license. You know, the Calibri lead, which the 3D seismic was acquired over, is potentially 200 million barrel recoverable field. We have a CPR supporting that number. And you know, if Jamaica was drilled and came in, it'd be a major success for the company and an absolute game changer. So it's really exciting, and that's kind of the blue sky excitement that we've gotten. You know, if Calibri came in, it opens up 15 at least follow-on targets to get after of similar size to Calibri, which is, you know, it just the mind boggles with the maths of the potential upside in Jamaica. It's a license we know really well. John and I worked on it when we worked in Tullow, so we're very familiar with it, and we have a material stake in it at 20%. Normally for a company of our size to get into an asset like this, you know, you're looking at single digit percentages, and you're normally looking at getting in at the very beginning of the work program, which normally means you're 5 years from drilling a well. What we liked about Jamaica was that we farmed in November, we acquired the seismic in March, April, you know, potentially drilling a well, you know, some stage later next year, early 20. So we got in at the right time of the life cycle. The CapEx burden isn't too big on us. We can afford it. And, you know, it has that upside for our shareholders. And if it wasn't to come in, it's not the end of the day. You know, there will be other opportunities that we'll be adding to the portfolio, similar opportunities. And I think where we'd like to get as a company, and it won't happen overnight, it'll take a little period of time, but where we'd like to get as a company is a situation where we're drilling one super wildcat well every 12 to 18 months. So giving our shareholders kind of that access to that huge blue sky upside. And as the European business grows, the intention would be that the European business is funding a lot of that exploration cost of these blue sky high impact super wildcat opportunities outside of Europe. So you're really looking to build that business where Europe is funding you know, the upside on, you know, drilling one of these super wildcats once every 12 to 18 months is where we want to get to.
Yeah, well, talking about Jamaica, on your release, which I found quite surprising, it says, you said only 11 wells have been drilled in the area to date in Jamaica, and despite difficulties with well placement due to lack of seismic control, 10 of these have encountered hydrocarbon shows. That's a high rate, isn't it?
It is, and that was what attracted us to the license back in 2014 when we worked for Tullow. You know, I mean, if you stand back and look at the information that we've got, I mean, there's also the SEEPs, which I think it was CGG published a report or snippets of a report where they discovered onshore SEEPs, and Tullow also we also discovered an offshore SEEP. So you couple all the little pieces of the jigsaw, and we're still missing some pieces, but you know, if you start together, you're starting to see potentially a working hydrocarbon system offshore Jamaica. So it was one of the things that we were really excited about is when we worked in Tullow. And, you know, when we started United, it was always in our minds to try and get some equity in Jamaica because we'd just seen the potential of it. And we believe in it, and we believe in the Jamaican story. And we think that, you know, it could be a new you know, bait and opening opportunity, and to be in at such a material equity is, you know, it's unique for a company of our stage. And the capex, the best bit, Justin, the capex requirement isn't, you know, it's a hell of a lot of money in any man's language. It's going to cost us about £2.5 million. We've already spent a chunk of that, but you know, it's a lot of money in any man's language. But in the grander scheme of things, in the oil and gas industry, for the potential upside on that money, it's, you know, it's fantastic value.
Yeah. Okay. Value. Let's go towards. I put in the recent blog, I wrote there's two sort of milestones coming up. That was before you announced the license. Like I said, it's always changing your story. But it's before you were announced awarded that Crown license provisionally. So Coulter, the appraisal well, it was Q2 or Q3. It's going to happen still.
Q3. Yeah. Q3. Most likely Q3. We signed the letter of intent with Ensco for the rig about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think. So yeah, we're in well planning now. So really looking forward to drilling that. It's a fantastic opportunity. And again, you know, we tend to forget about it because Jamaica gets the headlines, but Coulter by itself could actually be a company maker. You know, it could be a mini witch farm. It's 10 miles south of Witch Farm. It's an area we know well. We've spent a lot of time working on it. We believe the concept of that area. So we're really looking forward to it. It'll be an exciting summer leading up to drilling, and we think it'll be, well, we're hoping it'll be a great result for our shareholders.
Yeah, well, I know Barney, you know, the oil and gas analyst says, but 8.8 pence per share on its own. So on that, and so how do you? I mean, can you, you know, put a chance of success on that, or not on that? Drill,
well, we have a CPR. We have a CPR that has, I think it's just north of 50% chance of success. It is an existing discovery, so there is hydrocarbons there. It's just whether or not they're commercial enough. We certainly feel that we are, otherwise we wouldn't have committed to drilling this. So we certainly believe in the prospect. We believe that it could potentially be you don't know until you drill these things ultimately, but we certainly feel that, we're certainly confident that it'll be a commercial success. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And talking about, you know, commercial success, so let's talk about the operational update. You know, in Italy, what's happening there? What's you announced this morning? Some news?
Yeah, the development plan has been submitted to the Italian Ministry with an RNS out this morning. So we're making really good progress on that. We're happy with the development plan. The plan is to install an automated gas plant that can produce 150,000 cubic meter gas per day. So we're firmly on the road to production, but what we're also really excited about, what attracted us to the Italian license in the first instance was Selva, but was also East Selva. That's actually potentially, you know, a multiple of what we've currently got in Selva. So the next step is to acquire some 3D seismic over at East Selva later this year, early 2019. And hopefully look to drill a well at some stage later next year. But what's interesting is we have to go through this process in Italy to convert what is an exploration license into an exploitation license. Mm-hmm. And once that's done for Selva, it will apply to East Selva. So we won't at this time lag to production. If we drill a well in East Selva, which if it's a success, it can be tied back and put straight into production. It'd be essentially be a plumbing job. So the exploration piece in Italy was actually what attracted us to the license initially. So we're really excited about moving that forward. We're currently planning for the 3D along with our joint venture partners. So we'll look forward to moving that forward as well. So lots happening in Italy.
Okay, before I ask you about if you've got any other things going on with you, still looking around, I mean, just to clear up, at the bottom of the RNS, you've got a little table there of all your interest in your licenses there. Crown, the recent, you know, acquisition there in North Sea, is not there. Why is that then?
It's at this stage, it's been provisionally awarded. It's kind of a technicality. My understanding is that the OGA will issue a note or a letter of offer that we need to assign to accept the acreage, and I think once that's formally done, the acreage is formally ours. But we have been awarded the acreage, and you know, it's more of an administrative formality. And unfortunately, until we formally receive the acreage, we can't actually list it as our own. But it will be, and okay. We're very, very pleased. In fact, you know, Crown's interesting because I personally see it as a real development milestone for the company, because certainly a year ago we wouldn't have been awarded this license, and I'm not even sure 6 months ago we would have been awarded this license. But in terms of development of the company, we've moved the company forward so much in the last few months that we've managed to secure that secure that license. And you know, we looked at a lot of opportunities in this licensing round, and we just kept coming back to Crown. It just stood out to us as one where we could create and deliver value for our shareholders. It's an existing discovery, potentially up to 16 million barrels of oil recoverable. That's our own estimate. Mid case, potentially 9 million barrels. So it's a fantastic one to add to the portfolio. Work program isn't overly burdensome, so we're very, very pleased, and we have the funding in place for the work program. So we always have something in our back pockets, and this was one that we kept in our back pocket for a little while. We didn't talk too publicly about it until we actually got the award. So yeah, we're very pleased.
Yeah, when you say it's an existing discovery, was that for ConocoPhillips? Is it a while back? Was it?
Yeah, it is. It was a well drilled in 1998 by Conoco, and it was a discovery. I don't think it was deemed commercial at the time, but applying some you know, a lot's happened since 1998 in the industry technically, and applying some modern science to it really changes the landscape quite dramatically, and particularly with Crown. I mean, if we certainly feel that you know, there's a modern development plan, some repossessing the seismic, and you know, all of a sudden you could have a fantastic opportunity that really has cost the shareholders practically nothing.
Okay, and you just kind of answered my question there. I was going to say, why isn't it producing? And essentially, that, you know, like you say, the technology has leaped, gone advanced so much since then that you think now reprocessing of that seismic would help you hopefully discover something commercial. Is that right?
Absolutely, and I have to give credit to Joe Madrell on this, our geoscientist. He worked very hard working up the license application and identifying the right license for us alongside John Leather. So the team did a fantastic job on this, and you know, this award, in my view, is a real you know, it was a real validation of the team and the work that they put into it to get this. And you know, look, it's exciting. It's the field itself is located, the block itself is located very close to Piper and McCullen and the Barton field. So it's in a mature area. We're really looking forward to executing the work program and moving the license on. We've 95% of it. So we're effectively, we are the license administrator, which is the first step in becoming an operator. So that in itself as well is a real development for the company, and you know, we'll move it along, and maybe we'll be talking to some interested parties about a potential farm down you know, later in the year, early next year.
Yeah, well, you did say at the start that you're aware that you have to have enough to de-risk sort of portfolio, and but you don't want too much, just to dilute too much. Mm. And so are you still looking, and how much is too much? How many, you know, licenses are too much?
We're always looking. What I mean is, when we listed, we said we were going to build a portfolio of assets. Mm. And we've done that. And now we need to develop this portfolio. And we have a huge amount of high impact news flow over the next 6 to 12 months from the existing portfolio. But what we need to do is to take that next step. Value, we need to look a little bit wider and look at, well, you know, do we look at a corporate acquisition? Do we look at a portfolio acquisition? They're the type of opportunities we're starting to look at next, where it'll give us that potential step change of value. Now, that doesn't mean we're not looking at standalone opportunities. We absolutely are, because, you know, you'd be stupid not to. But certainly, you know, over the next number of months, we'll continue to look at, you know, corporate potential acquisitions and portfolio acquisitions. And that's one of the great strengths that Graham Martin brings to our team, and that he's done that several times for Tullow, many, many times, acquisitions and divestments. So he brings a lot of experience to help us identify and execute those transactions. And what we're looking to do really is, this is the bit where we need to be careful. We need to think clever. Mm. You know, what we want to avoid at all costs is dilution. So we're looking at opportunities that we, you know, might be a little bit different, might be structured differently, will be cleverer deals. You know, we've got paper we can use as well. There's all different ways we can structure things. And I think what we're looking at now is kind of identifying those clever deals that you can do with minimum dilution but maximum upside for our shareholders. And it'd be fair to say we're advancing a couple of things that I'm really, really excited about. But you know, they're not done until they're done. But we and you can't be sure that they'll be done until they're over the line. But we are advancing a couple of things, and you know, hopefully we're adding something to the portfolio. You know, over the course of the summer and the autumn. Mm. So, but we've a lot to keep us busy. We need to make sure we're developing the portfolio, creating as much value as we can from that. and you know, doing everything we can to see that value recognised in the share price.
Yeah, well, you have got a lot going on. I mean, for, you know, for a company of your size and market cap of just 15 million market cap, I don't know any company that has as many interests in peers of yours anyway. So to summarise, if someone's listening to this and they like the sound of what you're talking about and how much you're talking about it and what you're progressing, but are not yet following the story, Brian, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Justin, I could probably give you 20 reasons for it.
That's the problem, I know.
but to give you a few, I mean, we've high impact news flow coming up over the next 6 to 12 months, including drilling Calder with Corallian. We're going to continue to de-risk Watercross in advance of well planning late summer. We're going to commence the processing of the Jamaica 3D seismic. We've got 3D seismic planning coming up for East Selva. You know, on top of that, we've got an option agreement with Swift for the Aker prospect in Southern North Sea. We're working with them to attract additional partners. And we've got the development plan for Selva submitted to the ministry. And we're continuing to look to add to the portfolio via really clever structured deals that avoid dilution. So we've a lot of high impact news flow coming up over the next 6 months. And I think even if you look back since the turn of the year, you know, the news flow that's come out of United has been, in my view, quite strong and impressive. And every news item we've had is material. Mm-hmm. Material to the portfolios, material to the shareholders. And no doubt soon we'll see it reflected in our share price.
Marvellous stuff. Oh, I think that was more than three, definitely. But I'll let you go on that, Brian. Thanks for that, Brian. Like I say, you're very busy, so it'd be nice to catch up very soon. And thanks for speaking to us.
Thanks, Justin. Talk to you soon. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me right now is Joe Salomon, Managing Director of OilX. That's OEX ticker. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Nice to be here again.
Yeah, well, you've had some news out, and we'll cover that in a bit. But as always, for people listening right now not familiar with the company, explain, summarise what OilX is all about, if you could, Joe.
Certainly. OilX, oil and gas company with a main project in India, a very active Indian staff. And we're looking there at developing a large gas resource using unconventional drilling techniques and stimulation techniques. Trying to get that moving.
Okay, excellent stuff. Well, the news out is that you've issued an event of default to your partner GSPC. Could you sort of provide a background around that? What's it all about, Joe?
Yeah, GSPC is an Indian company. We've worked with them for a long time, and they have to say that they have funded some significant work programs in the past. But for a number of years, they have been experiencing financial difficulties and they've not been in a position to pay all of their cash calls. And that's even gone as far as routine and necessary work. And reflecting the long relationship that we've had with them, we have tried to be supportive as far as we can for several years. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we can't carry them indefinitely without a clearer roadmap forward. And their position is actually impeding our progress in the project. It's interesting to note also the government of India policy to reduce the country's reliance on energy imports leaves our project with a potentially significant part to play in delivering gas in the future. And given GSPC's lack of ability to pay their way, we've taken the only option remaining and we have issued default notices in accordance with the provision of the joint operating agreement.
Okay. And so what, you know, are the possible outcomes of this course of action you've issued here?
Well, under the terms of the joint operating agreement, which governs the behaviour between the two parties, GSPC has 60 days to remedy the default. If they don't remedy default by paying the amounts that are defaulted, they forfeit their 55% participating interest to OilX, and we will effectively go to 100% equity and then can move the project forward. GSPC can remedy the default by making the payment. Until they remedy the default, their rights under the joint operating agreement are suspended, so they can't attend operating and management committee meetings and they don't get information on what's happening in the project. While we're confident in our position, if GSPC fails to comply or a regulatory challenge is raised, then it may be necessary for OilX to consider other legal remedies.
Mm-hmm. And what will be, you know, the, for obviously shareholders listening to this, what will be the impact on OilX itself?
Look, our objective is simple. We have continuously maintained this position that we're looking to realise the potential value in the Cambay project by advancing the commercial development. The government of India agrees with this objective, and they've approved our field development plan and our application for a 10-year extension of the PSC. And like us, they want to proceed as soon as is practicable. To achieve this, we need a supportive partner that meets their obligations. And besides our outstanding cash calls, we're not looking for any specific value from GSPC's participating interest. Our intention really is just to bring in a new partner as quickly as we can in order to push the project forward, to allow it to go forward. And we have had dialogue with potential new partners. We believe we can achieve this. Our major shareholders continue to support our efforts, as evidenced by recent capital raisings, and we remain committed to the Cambay project and indeed India. We think it's an area of immense potential, and we really just want to get our Cambay project moving forward. So that's the story.
Okay, Joe, well, listen, if someone's listening to this and they don't know the story there yet at OilX, and they're sort of liking the sound of where you are and what you're doing, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
India is a place that people should be putting more attention on. The changes there are enormous. The opportunities are huge. We have a project which has potential value. The resource base, the gas volumes have been identified, and we remain single-mindedly focused on pursuing that to a commercial outcome. So that's point one. Point two, we're taking important steps to allow the work program to proceed, to realise that value. And this issuing the default notice is one of these key things that we're doing. And point number three, we have continued investor support for the company and for our efforts in the project. So people looking at us should take comfort that our major shareholders continue to support us strongly.
Marvellous stuff, Joe. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. It's a joint fifth, actually. It's Ferrum Crescent, FCR, and Jangada Mines, J-A-N. Those are two of the companies, two of five companies, I think will outperform in 2018. H2, it's just a blog, it's just my opinion. And you can read that, by the way, it's going to be voxmarkets.co.uk/blog. I also do a video on there. First time I've done a video like that, where I chat to the screen, basically. At four, another one, C4X Discovery Holdings, C4XD, I write about. At three, another one, it's Cora Gold Limited, and that's C-O-R-A. Sorry, I apologise, Cora. Obviously, it's Cora. It's Cora, that's how you spell it. C-O-R-A, not to be confused with Coro. At two, Clough Natural Resources, C-L-N-R. And number one, most followed company, is Immu Pharma, I-M-M. Tim, the chairman, will be on the podcast very soon. Okay. Top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Echo Energy. That's Echo ticker. Drilling commences at ELA1. At four, Prospects Oil and Gas, PXOG. Production congestion application submitted in Italy. I covered the chart with Nicola. I'm having problems speaking, to be honest with you, but I do cover the chart with Nicola. Technical analysis soon on the podcast, and you can see the video as well. At three, 88 Energy, operations update. As 88 ticker. At two, I just spoke to Neil, Vesarian, consumer goods collaboration. Number one, most liked RNS came from United Oil and Gas, operations update. And of course, I chatted to Brian there. They've got a lot going on for a sub 15 million market cap. Progress at Poder Galena. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.